pleasure to introduce to you our speaker for this evening. She's listed as Geraldine D., but she calls herself Jerry from Blairstown, New Jersey. What a wonderful, wonderful group. It's a real thrill to stand up here. Look at all you folks, and I wish I was down there and you were up here. My name is Jerry Delaney, and I'm a grateful alcoholic and drug addict.
Hi, Jerry.
I want to thank Clem and his committee for inviting me and all of you for tolerating the old bag, as they call me. You know, there comes a time when you get past the age of being young, and then you come out here, and then you fall over a barrier, and you get two black eyes, which you never had before when you were drunk. Now, there's something wrong here, and I think it's me. Of course, I think Clem pushed me. Of course, I didn't see him for about 6 hours afterwards or 8 hours or something else, but I still think that he said, give her a push. Seriously, it's a real thrill to talk to you, but it's a tough act to follow that young lady that talked last night. So you won't be thinking about how long is she sober and how old is she. I am 83 years young. I still work with alcoholics 8 to 12 to 14 hours a day, and I'm 43 years sober one day at a time. Now, all I've got to say to all of you, if you get tired of sitting or listening before I get tired of talking, either raise your hand or leave the room. You know, we all get long-winded when we've got a captive audience. And you're pretty captive, although I see people moving around, and I'm for them. They've already told me what to say, so I'll have no problem with that. I come from a different era than most of you here, because in my time, cocaine was over the counter. In the tobacco store, because we only fed it to farmhands, nobody wanted cocaine. And nobody wanted weeds because the Indians were in trouble and they were fighting with the North Americans. And they smoked weeds, which is pot, and nobody wanted to be an Indian. But guess what we wanted in my era? We wanted the illegal drug, alcohol. Oh, boy. We had stills in the basement that blew up every once in a while and ruined the house. It tasted like rot gut all the time. But that's what we wanted. Boy, that was the end thing. And I wanted to be popular. And in those days, girls, there were no permanents. And I was a homely little mutt. But I wanted the boys to like me, and I found a way. I could go across the Canadian border with a couple of friends of mine, and we would get 2 hot water bottles full of Canadian whiskey. Now, you practiced with water before you went, so you wouldn't flush if the border guards made you get out. But the reason they selected me to do this was that I was so skinny, and the inside of my thighs would just accommodate those hot water bottles beautifully. And you put cotton pads between them so it wouldn't squeak. And away you went. And when I got to the party with 2 quarts of Canadian whiskey, honey, I was popular. I didn't even drink. And they liked me all the better because I didn't drink any of it. Left more for them. I didn't take a drink until I was almost 20 years old. And I had some bathtub gin. One of the great things in my life had happened to me. I didn't think it was great at the time. But it was during the Depression. My father was the local banker and lumberman and farmer and coal miner, whatever. He owned the coal mines and he owned 3,000 acres of land and blah, blah, blah. And I was the spoiled daughter of the rich. And I was just graduating from college and he called up and said, "Honey, how much money have you got in your pocket?" And I said, $60. He said, "That's all there is and you'll have to take care of your mother too. She's up in Chicago," and I was down the center of the state in Illinois. And he said, "Get up there the best way you know how." And from doing nothing and being spoiled and being a brat, I took 3 jobs and I worked like a dog. And I dressed out of the thrift shop, and it was the best thing that ever happened to me. Oh, I had problems. I had a lot of problems. I had an alcoholic mother who was constantly getting drunk. Verna was a closet drinker. Verna was supposedly had a bad gallbladder. And the doctor would come across the street. He lived across the street and had his office across the street. And he'd come over and give Verna the new medicine that was going to cure everything. Heroin. So Verna was a drunk and she was on the heroin and I was still skinny and still odd looking and not very happy about anything. Father was a hard shell Baptist, and for a hard shell Baptist to ever get drunk was just impossible, but he got drunk a couple of times in his life, and that was terrible. But you see, there had always been a tug of war between Mama and Papa about what was right and what was wrong, because Papa was a Baptist and Mother was a Methodist, and I finally came to the age of discretion, age 7, and that was my mother's decision. And I joined the Methodist Church, and when my father asked me in front of both ministers why I joined the Methodist Church, I said it has more stone steps than the Baptist Church does. And from then on, there was war. Mother and I fought like crazy, always did. Why? Because we were so much alike. She was an alcoholic, and I was coming that way, although at that time I wasn't drinking. And when I did start to drink, I'll never forget the first night I took the first drink. It was wonderful. Where had that wonderful stuff been all my life? What in the world had I been saying no to that stuff for? And I never did again until I had to get sober. Did I get in trouble? Yeah, but I was traveling 8 months out of the year with a group of doctors, and I was traveling the fast track. Somebody asked me if I ever got in trouble while I was out with the doctors, and I said yes. The head of a very large hospital and I went out one night and got drunk, and we came back to the hotel in Boston. And in those days, Boston was very staid. Oh, you just didn't say anything out of order or do anything out of order. And we came back to the hotel drunk and heard nice music coming from one of those terraced ballrooms where you step down the step, about 10 of them, and get down to the dance floor. And we decided to go dance, and we stepped down the steps very gingerly and started to dance, and we were invited to leave the floor, and we declined. I mean, after all, didn't they know who we were? And pretty soon the police came in and got us, and we got off as soon as we told them who we were, but we had crashed a debutante full dress ball in Boston in the early 40s. And you just didn't do that. What happened to the doctor I was with? He wasn't as fortunate as I was. And he retired and moved out in this direction. And he died of acute alcoholism. What happened to me? Well, I had started the psychiatry route. You see, I didn't have to pay the doctors because of the job I had. And rather recently, I spoke to a big clinic that shall remain nameless. And just before I went on the platform, they told me that there were 20 psychiatrists sitting over to the right. And I thought, well, I better handle that and get it out of my hair. And I told them that I was awful glad they were there because they were the most uneducated, underprivileged doctors in the whole United States. And you could hear the hush. Everybody was just terrified of what I was going to say. And I said, I'm going to tell you why. And I'm going to tell you why. I fooled 23 psychiatrists. I would get, quote, overtired and exhausted, and they would put me in the hospital. I didn't have to pay for it, so I didn't care. It was a nice rest. And they'd have nurses around the clock, private nurses, to take care of the madam. And the whole thing went along rather well, and I'd get rested, and then I'd go back home, and I'd wait a few months before I did it again. But 23 of these guys, the last one was head of the psychiatric department of the Mayo Clinic, and he saw me every day for 3 months, Saturdays and Sundays included, and he had a wonderful diagnosis. I was outrageously overworked and underpaid. And I was the best paid woman in the United States at the time and the most spoiled. And that just was fine, but there was a smart aleck among those doctors. And he decided to put me on leave of absence for a year with full pay, benefits. I had a house and a car and a maid and a chauffeur and a handsome salary. But I was offended that they dare put the Queen on hold. But I went on hold because they gave me a nice sum of money, and then resigned. And they again gave me a nice sum of money. And the thing that happened was I really went on a tear then. And I got drunk all over the United States. I cannot tell you what I did with that money in five figures, which at that time was a lot of money. But I supposedly had a good time. I was drinking. The doctors never knew I was drinking because I was taking medication. And you see, I had the opportunity to buy all the things over the counter that are controlled now. And we had a standing joke in our office. We'll try the new medicine on Jerry, and if it doesn't kill her, it won't hurt the patient. And it almost killed me. But they never knew until after the fact that I drank like I did. And I went out, and on a tear, I could not tell you where I went or what I did. You talk about blackouts. I walked and I talked and I functioned, but I have no idea where or why or what. God is good to me because I didn't get in more trouble than I did. But one morning I wakened and I was in a funny looking iron bed. And I looked over to the right and there were bars on the window. And to the left, and there was a peephole in the door. And as one of our old-timers says, a sloppy architect forgot to put the doorknobs on. And I know right where I was. I was in a nut factory. And that's where I was. Now, I had had a problem before this, and that's why I drank. I want you to know why I drank. I had a moral leper brother who drank too much. Oh, he was just terrible. He overspent his money and he had a terrible, terrible time. And he had been an awful trial to me. But I had a bright idea one day, and I called the only child psychiatrist on the Eastern Seaboard at that time and said, "Jim, I've got a moral leper brother who drinks too much. What do you do with a moral leper who's a drunk?" He said, "Gee, Jerry, I don't know. Now, wait a minute. The other night I was at a medical meeting in New York, and there was a guy there by the name of Bill Wilson, and he was doing something peculiar with men who drank too much. Not women, understand, men. He said, he gave me his card, I'll call him up." And he called our beloved Bill, our founder. And Bill went out to Maplewood, New Jersey, 50 years ago last November, to see my brother. And my brother bought the program, the whole thing. He swallowed it right down to his gut. And he was sober until his death. And he would have been sober 50 years last November. He learned a lesson very well. Don't talk to those nearest and dearest about their problem. And I would say, "Do you think I'm drinking too much?" He'd say, "Certainly not." Well, I said, "I don't think so either." But you see, I was getting suspicious. But you know, that was to persist even after I got sober. He would not give me advice. And for any of you who have relatives that are in the program, about to be in the program, or children, for God's sake, take a lesson from him. Because if he had told me one single thing, I would have said, "You moral leper, how dare you talk to me?" Because he was drunk. I was overworked. And I was underpaid. You know about that. But he didn't, and he went to AA because Dr. Plant called Bill And Bill and two guys went out to Maplewood, New Jersey to see my brother. And after that, Lois and Bill used to spend the weekends from the spring through the early fall in my brother's house. Because, you know, many of you saw that video on Bill and Lois. And didn't that apartment look attractive? And didn't that job in Macy's basement look marvelous? That's the biggest lie that's ever been told. That basement apartment was hotter than hell, and the drunks had stolen most of Lois's furniture, everything from lampshades on up and down. And that job she had in Macy's basement was like working in a hell hole. And she was a wonderful, wonderful woman. Let's never forget that. And for all the Al-Anons in the room, you'd be grateful that she was the kind of a woman she was, or there wouldn't be any AA, or there wouldn't be any Al-Anon. When they would come out occasionally while I was traveling, I would stop by at my brother's for a weekend, and I would talk to Bill. And I never wanted to say Alcoholics Anonymous or AA. That was a dirty word. And so I said, Bill, how do you work that thing? And I was always using my hands like this. How do you work that thing? Now, he'd been in town's hospital three times. I made it seven. He listened to Dr. Silkworth, and I threw Dr. Silkworth out of my room because I was expecting a psychiatrist to talk to me about my psychiatric problems, and he came in to talk to me about alcohol, and I threw him out, and I asked him to come back later, and he wouldn't come. Why, what a thing. But I finally get up nerve, and I'd say, Bill, how do you work that thing? And he was always slow to talk. And he'd say, Jerry, don't drink. Don't take those pills. Go to meetings. And after a long pause, he'd say, and shut up. How dare he tell me to shut up? A great and intelligent person like I am. So dumb that I couldn't even see what I was. But he was always good to me. And Lois, God rest her soul, would always listen to my bitching about my moral leper brother. And she'd say, well, Jerry, it's going to be all right one day at a time. And so I was blessed with seeing a lot of them, both before I quit drinking and afterwards. They were gentle, kind, simple people who really lived one day at a time in God's grace. And we are the most fortunate people in the world to have leaders like that. As I say, when I found myself in that locked room, I knew where I was. And all of a sudden, I got very humble. I stopped calling my brother a moral leper. And I said out loud, if I ever get out of here, I'm going to ask my brother if he'll help me. And the first miracle of AA came to me at that time. Because 20 minutes later, he stepped off the elevator in that nut house in Chicago. He'd been called many times before, but didn't think I was even ready, but somehow he knew my being in the lockup was a little more serious, and he decided to come. when I stopped crying, he said, "Honey, you've made a pretty lousy mess out of your life. Do you want to do something about it?" Well, I did want to do something about it, but I didn't want to go with that bunch of holy rollers that were praying all the time, saying the Lord's Prayer and praying before the meeting, and I didn't want to have anything to do with them, because, you see, I didn't believe in God. By the way, the early AA people said, "What about good orderly direction if you don't believe in God?" And that worked very, very well with me a little bit later. But my brother said, "Do you want to do something about your life?" As I say, I wanted to do something, but not with that gang. But being the liar we are, crossed my fingers and said, "Yes, I do." And we flew that day from Chicago to Newark, New Jersey. Now, we had to land in Allentown. If you know anything about that country there, it's very hilly, and I was used to the flatlands, and I didn't have anything in my gut for 48 hours, and I thought I was going to die. And then, to make matters worse, he took me over to the local hotel and sat me in the lobby with no money while he taught two classes at Rutgers. Well, I'm dying. You know, after you've been drinking that long and taking that many pills, 20 years, you're a little nervous when they stop it suddenly. To put it mildly. So I made a very important decision. I had never, never, never asked anybody to buy me a drink. But I went in the ladies' room to fix up my hair, put some powder on my nose, because he'd left me with no money. And I took one look at myself in the mirror, and it even frightened me. I didn't have guts enough to go in the bar looking like that. So I sat it out, shaking it out. And I had DTs coming off of it, but I was afraid to tell anybody for fear they might lock me up or put me away. I saw things coming through the wall and men walking through the doors and animals crawling underneath the molding around the place. But I was afraid to share it with anybody. Very shortly after I came back with him, they started taking me to meetings as soon as they could get me cleaned up, because I was a pretty rough mess. And they didn't say, like you say, "Now, would you like to go to a meeting, dear?" They said, "Come on, we're going to a meeting." "I don't feel like it." "Who asked you if you felt like it? You drank every day, didn't you?" You see, AA was 99.9% pure male. They didn't want women in that nice little organization of theirs, and they made it very plain to me. They didn't make any bones about not wanting me there. I was number 4 woman in New York and New Jersey, and I still hadn't joined AA. I was there. I wasn't drinking. But I'm grateful tonight to the non-alcoholic women who let me sit with them, because the women sat on one side and the men sat on the other. And if you had a problem, you went to somebody's house afterwards, and the women gossiped and the men talked about their problems, and they didn't ever include me in that. Lois was awfully good to me when she was there in saying, "This too will pass, Jerry." And she would talk to me about AA and what I needed. And she said, "Just don't drink. Don't take pills. go to meetings, and like Bill, she says, and shut up. But I didn't shut up very much. I had this magpie mouth going all the time. And time went on. I got a little bit better, a little bit at a time. And they kept criticizing me because I didn't like the big book. They gave me a big book, and I thought it was the most poorly written book I'd ever seen. And I threw it out the window in the snow. But it was an unusual book. It had legs. It came back on my night table. And I threw it in the dirty clothes that were going to the laundry. Wouldn't come back from there, would it? Yeah, it did. Pretty good condition, too. And then I threw it in the garbage. You know something? It walked out of that garbage. Came back a little greasy, but my brother had taken me home to live in his house, and his wife wasn't very keen about that sister-in-law who was a drunk living there, and made it very clear to me. But she was the one that rescued that book. And it was eventually to save my life, because I'd been finally managed to be sober about 8 months. I wouldn't say sober, dry, not drinking, not drugging, going to meetings, but I hadn't joined anything or anybody. Oh, yes, I said, yes, yes, phony, right on through to the core. And I finally made an important decision, because I had gone back to work at the hospital, and I had some money, and after all, I could drink like a lady, couldn't I? I'd shown I was a lady all my life. By whose standards? Who? And so I made an important decision. I was going to return to Chicago and join my friends to drink like a lady. And I saved money and bought a ticket. And I got my bags packed and kept them under the bed where my sister-in-law wouldn't find them, because she went to the bathroom with me too, the old witch. They were afraid I'd jump out the window, and I probably would have. But she went to the bathroom with me, but I hid the bags successfully, and I was all ready to go, had everything lined up. And I went to South Orange, which was the first group in New Jersey, to meet him. I can't tell you what they said or who was there or anything about it. But I came home that night, still determined to leave, and sat down on the side of the bed, and that stinking book was there. And for the first time, I willingly picked it up. And it fell open to page 57 in the first edition, the chapter on how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And it was beginning to dawn on me that I was following only the path of destruction. And that word honest in that first paragraph was an inch high, and I hated it like poison. They knew I was honest, didn't they, while I'm gritting my teeth? No, they knew I was dishonest. And I went on down and started to read the steps. Nobody had told me to do this. This is the first miracle in AA for me. I started to read the steps in the first person. Maybe you know that when they were writing the steps, they told Bill to put the material he had down so that they could all work at it. And he wrote that in the first person. I admit that I am powerless over alcohol and that my life is unmanageable. And I started to read those steps in that way. I don't know why. I'd never done it before. I don't know that I've ever done it since. But I went on through the steps, reading them in that way, closed the book, and laid down and went to sleep. I wakened in the morning. Remember, I'd gone to sleep with the determination to leave, to run away, to never have anything to do with any of you again. When I wakened in the morning, I sat up on the side of the bed and something occurred to me immediately. I'd had the first decent night's sleep that I'd had in 8 months. I'd slept all night. And that in itself was a miracle. And then it dawned on me that the real miracle had happened. Because the desire to leave had been lifted from me, never to return from that day to this. From then on, I began to learn about me. It wasn't easy, because as I say, there were very few women. But I was determined to do it. And we started to work on women in the area, most of whom we didn't get. But we went to AA. We went all over the state of New Jersey, New York, Connecticut. Any place there was a meeting, we drove hundreds of miles to get to a meeting. And today, we could almost walk out our front door and fall into a meeting. But we couldn't then. And we had to go long distances. But let me tell you about those long distances. The best AA meetings I ever went to were in the car, when we talk going and talk coming back, and the attitude changes. The wives were very good to me. They allowed me to come to the couples groups because in those days, this was a family group. The wives went to all of the meetings, and there wasn't a lot of hanky-panky like there is now. That was the best thing about it. But from then on, I began to really grow. And one day at a time, it has gotten nothing but better. There were some incidents along the way that were a little hairy. And one of them was that I met a tall, good-looking Irishman, 50 years old, bachelor who had never been married, Roman Catholic, came complete with aged mother as a package. I'm hard-shell Baptist, career and divorced. Because one of the things that I thought made me drink was when my stepson, who decided to live with me when his father and I got a divorce when he was 16, was killed in the armed forces at 21. But here I am in love with this Irishman. When you guess what? I married him. That's when my initials, instead of being Go, became God. My initials are G-O-D. And so when the students at my rehab say, "Who do you think you are, God?" And I say, "Well..." I didn't pick it out. But we decided to get married, and we did. And let me tell you something. He was sober a little less time than I was, but I loved that guy the day I met him, and I loved him the day he died, and I could have stuck a butcher knife in him and turned it around and watched him bleed to death 100 times in between. And let me tell you something, men and women do not think alike. Thank God. But we didn't kill each other. I wanted to talk at AA meetings about me taking all the drugs, because I could get them by the bottle full and the handful and went around taking a good deal. And when I stopped them coming into AA, I became a crusader. And there's nothing worse than a woman crusader. And I began to talk about them at AA meetings, and I began to get criticism. "Why doesn't she talk about alcohol?" Well, you know, one of my great psychiatric friends say that their pills are nothing but dehydrated alcohol that doesn't smell. And so if you... that's one of the definitions that makes it easy to sell. And so as time went on, I began to get feeling lousy about this. My husband and I had been married then about 20 years, and he'd been Mr. AA and head of intergroup and a real good hard rock AA guy who helped hundreds and hundreds of people. That I must give him credit. Yes, we had our fights. Yes, we had our disagreements. Yes, an Irishman and a Welshman will kill each other easily. But we didn't. And we loved each other when love is understanding whether you approve or not. I didn't always approve of what he did, but I understood. And I loved him in spite of what he did or wanted to do. So he had been very active in helping a lot of people. As a matter of fact, he was sponsor to a man who works for me now and has been working for me for 30 years. And he had his own construction business and seemed very happy. He was very successful as far as money was concerned in his business. Everything seemed to be going well. But I don't think he ever quite bought the fact that the mood changers in the solid form will alter your thinking enough to until you return to the drug of choice, which with most of us is alcohol. It was my drug of choice. And so he had a bad back, and one of his AA friends gave him some muscle relaxant and said, "Don't tell Jerry, she's a nut on those things." And he took it, and he didn't tell me, and it relieved his back. The next thing that this guy gave him was some non-alcoholic cough medicine, but it contained triple bromide, which is a sedative that we used to use a great deal, and you hardly ever hear of it anymore. But he said, don't tell Jerry, she'll raise hell about this. Unfortunately, after 20 years of sobriety, being Mr. AA, and he was chairman of New Jersey Intergroup, he took this cough medicine, and 2 days later, he was in the bar, drunk. Unfortunately, he was in the hospital 14 times in the next 17 months. And he bled to death alone in a halfway house from an esophageal hemorrhage. I made one decision right there. We always return to the drug of choice, which is usually alcohol. And I will never stop talking about those things that activate the desire to drink as long as I live. It was a hard blow for me to take, because in the meantime I had gotten mixed up with the treatment of alcoholics and I thought I couldn't do it alone. But God has a way of not giving us more than we can stand, particularly if we keep working on ourselves, not on the people we treat. Being in the treatment field, my friend, does not help you keep sober. It's apt to get you drunk. I knew that. I've remembered it from that day to this. And I started more and more going to meetings. By this time, of course, there are more women in AA. We had the first woman's meeting in New Jersey, met in my office. Marty Mann, who started the National Council, was a longtime friend of mine, and I started the third branch of the National Council on Alcoholism because people need to be educated. Until they know the answer, how are we going to get the sick people in our hands? But they have to know that AA is the only answer that works. You can dry them out, and you can give them a lot of information. But unless they go to AA, it ain't going to work long. The Lord gave us good forgetters, and I'm glad He did. But the day I forget that I'm an alcoholic and that the way I stay sober is pass it on from one person to another, I'm in real trouble. I think we need to face some of the barriers that keep us from going to AA. And one is the word alcohol, ick. Doesn't that sound dirty? I always thought the ick on the end of alcoholic. There was a time when they were going to name it after the great Dr. Jelinek, a man that we called Bunky. Bunky would fit right under my arm, and he was about as big as the little guy from Fort Monmouth that was leading the AA meetings that I used to go to. And Bunky always said, shut up too. And that little guy, when I'd hold up my hand and want to talk, he'd say, shut up, shut up. I said, I thought you could do AA any way you wanted to. And that little squirt, he'd fit under my arm, looked down his nose at me, and he said, you don't have a way. And he was right. We don't have a way. We have to learn it from the people who've been down the road. And if they'd named it, instead of alcoholism or alcoholic, Jelinek's disease, and we were going for Jelinek's therapy, wouldn't it be wonderful? You folks have accepted alcoholism, but there's hundreds of thousands out there for you to work on who haven't. And if you want to call it something else to get them in and rub their nose in it, fine. I'm not against getting them here, regardless of how you get them here. When we stop to think about it, words may be bothering us a little bit. You know, alcohol, ick, is simply a substance that is used and interferes with some people's lives. Does it interfere with everybody's life? No, but let me say to you non-alcoholics in the room, you stink just as bad the next morning as your alcoholic did. You say, well, I only have one or two. You smell. You stink. You just don't forget it. And don't keep the medicine cabinet full of those little pills that you want to take for your this, that, and the other thing either. If you have to take them, hide them. Don't put them where somebody in a moment of terror might touch them. You know, the addict, when they're under strain, will look for relief. And having alcohol around the house, I think, is dangerous. If you're going to keep it locked up. When Tom and I were married, he had an Irish family that always drank, and while we only entertained them twice a year, that was twice a year too often. And we were sort of poor in the beginning, and we didn't dare throw the alcohol that we'd gotten to entertain them away. And I had it in the kitchen cabinet. And one morning I wakened and Tom had big hollows under his eyes. He said, for God's sake, Jerry, do something with that liquor out there. I almost drank it last night. I had a headache. And he was walking all night long and he knew that liquor was there. It doesn't take much. We have a low threshold for pain. And it doesn't take much to set us off. Somebody is always talking about having relapses. Relapse? Hell. Excuse me for my English. But this is simply a reactivation of your disease because you would rather be drunk than face reality in your life. Reality. One of the words that I had a lot of trouble with was wisdom. Wisdom. I'm never going to get wisdom. You know what wisdom is? Common sense developed to an uncommon degree, and there isn't anybody in this room that can't do that. And you know, don't, if a word bothers you, the first thing I recommend that you do is go to the dictionary. Look it up. It may not mean what you think it means. Because there's so much to be learned from our AA friends. And these are not things I learned from a book or I learned from training courses. These are things that I learned at AA. And one thing that I learned was that I don't want to reactivate my disease. And I have a list of things that I keep up in front of me. I have another sign on my dresser, too, that I think most of us need. And in great big letters, it's written, procrastination. Procrastination is my sin. It brings me endless sorrow. I really should stop doing it. In fact, I think I'll stop tomorrow.
You say, well, I feel all right today. I'm not going to prepare tomorrow. If your house isn't on fire today, does that mean you don't have a fire extinguisher there in case it catches on fire? And you better have some guidelines. In fact, what you need is 6 telephone numbers that are daytime numbers and 6 that are nighttime numbers. They may not be the same. But if you dial 12 numbers and don't get an answer from anybody, you'll pull the phone out of the wall and tell the telephone company they have no brains and have forgotten about why you were trying to get somebody on the phone. Simple little techniques like having these numbers, whether you think you're going to need them or not. Not just one sponsor. Oh, dear doctor, it's wonderful to have a sponsor. But you know, your sponsor might die, or they might be out of town, or they might not be available. Have you got other telephone numbers that you can talk to people? Or would you rather get drunk? Well, I don't want to tell people that I'm that weak. You aren't weak, you have a disease. And if you had any other kind of a disease, you'd go to any length to keep from getting it. One of the things as you get older in AA is go to meetings. Suppose nobody had been there when you came. Well, you say, I went for 5 years, I went for 10 years. Isn't that just lovely? Did you go for somebody else, or do you go to learn about you? Because if you're growing and if you're getting older, you're changing, either good or bad, and you better go to meetings. Go on time and preferably early, and stay after the meeting, stupid. The whole thing is be available. To help? No. Be available to be helped. Because anybody that you talk to, you'll get more out of it than they ever do. Because we are the receivers. When the weather's bad, you say, oh, well, I can't go to meetings. That's the good time to go to meetings. That's when you ought to go, for that's when you drank in bad weather, wasn't it? Then you go to meetings. What if you get a few wet feet or whatever? When you're at meetings, listen with a listening ear for the plus factor. Some people express themselves well and some not so well. But you know something? I've learned more from some of those who didn't express themselves so well. They weren't so glib, and they were reaching, and they were trying, and I was trying to help them think. And this is a good thing for you to do. What about business meetings in AA? Do you go to the business meetings of your own group? And if they ask you to do something, like clean up the dishes afterwards, are you saying, I'm too busy, I've got to go to work in the morning? Did you do that when you were drinking? What's that extra 15 minutes or 20 minutes? It'll do you more good than you know, because you need to remember from whence you came. If people ask you to do something on a committee that you don't really do, like work on this conference, either do it cheerfully or find a way to get it done, but don't complain and bitch about it. Just do it. This will help you more than it'll help the committee. Never mind whether it helps them or not. When people ask your opinion, if you have one, state it simply. But don't criticize other people that have different views. You didn't give them their ideas, but you're offering yours if you're asked. At meetings, often people don't show up to fix the coffee and put out the literature and set up chairs and do things like that. Or maybe you don't do that out here. Is this an affluent thing, or you still set up chairs? We do our way. Because of some emergency in their family, the car broke down, and blah, blah, blah. If you're there early, you can give help if it's needed. And you realize that if you're not there, there may not be help. Just know that your presence is very, very important. Try to be at the door to greet someone new or old. Sometimes the person who's been in for a while is sicker than some others. I remember my sponsor, she said, "Why aren't you over at the door saying hello?" "Oh," I said, "I hardly know anybody." She said, "What's your name?" I said, "Jerry." She said, "Go to the door and say, 'My name's Jerry, can I get you a cup of coffee?'" Do you think you can say that, you intellectual snob? She took all the snobbery right. She took me right down to the... She didn't... We need to get a lot out of groups, but we need to make a contribution too. And you say, "Well, I haven't got that much money." Did you have money to drink with? Did you buy a beer for 50 cents? Not around here, I guess. But you can put a little in. It's a little bit that makes the pot. Cooperation is the basis of success. Don't just talk about it. Do something. Get off your can and do it. You know, we have 3 D's in AA: a desire to quit, a decision to do it, and a determination to do what people tell us to do. We have to remember one thing: all people smile in the same language. And if we can't do anything else, we can at least look pleasant. Not like we just swallowed a sour pickle. And besides, you know, it takes 18 muscles to frown and only 8 to smile. And some of you folks are overworking your face, and you'll need a facelift. We used to say you should kiss a lot. Keep it simple, stupid. In my day, that's what they said. I like the new way better. Keep it simple spiritually. I resisted organized religion pretty strongly. And I had to get a hold of somebody. I don't know whether any of you knew the drunk monk out our way who's sober something over 20 years. But I said, what's this spirituality bit? What's this religion all about? He said, "Jerry, you've got things all mixed up. And I'm sober twice as long as he is." He said, "Spirituality is only part of religion. Religion has 2 things, dogma and spirituality. The dogma is how you set your table for your God. One church sets it one way, and one group sets it one way, and one group sets it another. Who's right?" I asked a couple of Catholic bishops one time, "How do you Catholics know you're right?" And he said, "We don't. Maybe we'll get up there and find out we're all wrong." And that's no lie. We may, you know, but we can do the best that we can today. And I said, "Well, what about the spirituality business?" He said, "Jerry, do you have a set of standards that you try to live by?" I said, "Why, of course. Do you think the day would be acceptable to the God of your understanding if you were to be called tonight?" I said, "Well, gee, I hope so." He said, "Have you your standards written down?" And I said, "Yes," and pointed to the 12 steps behind me. I said, "There they are. They're simple." He said, "That's all there is. Don't worry about how you set your table or how somebody else does. But set a table and live the way you feel God would want you to live." And, you know, I've gone back to the simplicity of child. And maybe some of you know this poem that I like so much. It's "Let Go and Let God." As children bring their broken toys with tears for us to mend, I brought my broken dreams to God because He was my friend. But then instead of leaving Him in peace to work alone, I hung around and tried to help with ways that were my own. At last I snatched them back and cried, "How can you be so slow?" "My child," he said, "what could I do? You just never would let go." And you know, this is one of the things that we have a great deal of trouble with. If we can just keep it simple and leave the activation to God, we will be a whole lot better. I find that little simple things that I carry with me in my pocket help. And I have some guidelines for daily sobriety that I carry with me. And one is to keep my goals realistically in line, remembering how old I am, where I've been. I don't have to be president of everything under the native sun. I can be a worker. You know, that might help. And I think I ought to be good to myself. God didn't make junk, you know that. And for a long time I thought I was junk after I got sober. But He never would let me out of the treatment field. I went in it by the back door, didn't want to go in it, but got sucked into it. And you think He'd let me out? No, that's 33 years ago, and I'm still in it. And I finally gave up and decided to do it His way. It's easier. I have to keep reminding myself not to worry about what other people think. 3/4 of the time, they're not even thinking about you or me and would care less. Help yourself. Bring your own self-esteem up instead of trying to run everybody's life. I have to make honesty and truth the key words in my life. And I don't know about you, but it's very, very hard for me to be honest with me. I can be honest with you easier than I can be honest with me. You know that cutting corners and quarter turning just a little bit, just fuzzing that picture a little bit. I have to be aware that other people have feelings and other people need support. I think you better raise your hand or leave the room. I think I'm with you. You know, I don't think staying sober is easy. I never found anything that was worthwhile that was easy. But I find that tough as it may be, this is the best thing that ever happened to me in my life. The first was my father. Yes, we all make mistakes. But we learn much more from our mistakes than we ever do from our successes. At least I have, and I think you will have, if you really want to learn. And then we have to have the courage to change the things in our life that we see we're doing. But, you know, the procrastination is my sin. It brings me endless sorrow. I really should stop doing it. In fact, I think I'll stop tomorrow. And you know, you don't have to. People say, well, what do you do when you can't get down on your knees when you're old? You lie on your back and talk to God. He's not fussy. Getting down is just a way of saying thank you. But if I get down on me, mine these days, I won't be able to get up. If we will work at AA and practice it in all our affairs, not just once in a while, but in all our affairs, we will find contentment like we never had before. I just feel that my life is a different place because I have come to AA. And what a fortunate thing to have been pushed into AA when I wouldn't do it of my own volition with my brother being right there. God is good to me, and God is good. And you know, I find a great many stories that I read that have such wonderful thoughts in them. And I don't know whether any of you know Og Mandino out here. How many of you know him? Yeah, he's one great guy. And in one of his books, The Greatest Success in the World, he points out to us that we need guidelines. Guidelines for us to follow. And he points out that he has some. And one is to work each day as if life were in the balance. And you know, I believe it is. Because sobriety isn't as easy as you think. You know, it's lurking. You go in the hospital, they want to give you some medicine. You go here, you go there, somebody says, well, a little wine in the food doesn't hurt much, does it? I went into a fancy restaurant in New York not too long ago, and there were three wine glasses in front of me, and a haughty-looking maitre d' turned them up, and I turned them down, and he turned them up, and I turned them down, and he turned them up, and I turned them down. And then his cheek sucked in, and the French, do you not wish wine, madam? I said, if I did it, I wouldn't turn glasses upside down. And he said, oh. And I said, see that cup there? Keep it filled. I had decaf in it. And pretty soon he comes around and he leans over and he whispers in my ear, are you by any chance a friend of Bill W.? We have to have patience, as Mandino says, if we want a future. Patience with others? No. Patience with us. We are the problem. Let them solve their own problem. But we've got to solve ours if we want to control the future. We have to have some plans for our life, don't we? At least I think we do. Am I going to complete mine? I don't know. But did I complete anything today? Yeah. I got up here with talk to you without dropping dead. And, you know, the thing is that even though you may be long time in the program, today is the day that counts. And today is the day that is most difficult. And we all get that perfectionist thing. I want to say something that will impress them. You know something? The only impression that was made is that you are wonderful, wonderful people. And I hope that you keep it simple and try to do as I do. Have something to say to your God at night. And each night I ask God to take my hand. It's better that way, I know. Because if I take His instead of His taking mine, I might get afraid and let go. Please, God, never let me let go of my source of help, AA, my source of spirituality, the God of my understanding. And may you all have sobriety as I've had it, one day at a time, this day and one more. And then if God sees fit to give you another one, be grateful. Be grateful. Because anything is possible if you're breathing. God bless you and keep you safe.